And now, a thought from Geico Motorcycle.
It took 15 minutes to take a spirit animal quiz online.
Please be the cheetah. Please be the cheetah.
And learn your animal isn't the cheetah, but the far less appealing blobfish.
Oh, come on.
To add insult to injury, you could have used those 15 blobfish minutes to switch your motorcycle insurance to Geico.
Geico. 15 minutes could save you 15% or more on motorcycle insurance.
Geico presents, yikes, another voicemail from your roommate.
Sup, roomie? Hey, a pipe burst in the basement. It's completely flooded. Anyway, I called for someone to fix it, but in the meantime, I was thinking we could finally have that indoor pool party we've always wanted. I got some cool swan floaty things already going. Could you pick up some chips on your way home? Later.
The Geico Insurance Agency could help keep your personal property protected. Like if your roommate isn't the brightest pool float in the flooded basement. Visit Geico.com to see how easy it is to switch and save on renter's insurance.
You're listening to Twig Fan Service, brought to you by ThisWeekInGeek.net and Anime on Request in St. Catharines, located at 314 Merritt Street, Niagara's largest anime store. And now, on with the show.
Hey everyone, this is Mike the Birdman Dodd, and you are not listening to This Week in Geek. You're actually listening to Twig Fan Service. Normally, I'd be joined with my ever-awesome co-host, Jordan Headphones Rutherford, but today, I'm joined with the ever-epic...
Steve Snowball Sailor. Yeah. I like the fact that I'm epic instead of just awesome.
Well, you are, because now you're on my other show. This is my vocal demo of awesomeness.
I feel like a guest. It's not really a co-host. I feel like a guest of this thing. It feels
exactly.
Awesome.
Because I want you on this show because you are an excellent interviewer.
Well, thank you, Mike. I definitely appreciate that.
And today we have a rather cool interview. This is the same guy we talked to during the FanX.
Yes. It was definitely back in August. We met him up. He's the awesome, awesome guy. He does the voice of Goku from Dragon Ball Z. Sean Schimmel.
That's right. Sean, say hello.
Hi, everybody.
So, yes, we are going to talk with Sean today as when we were...
I'm failing to understand why you're called the Birdman, because you're not a Birdman.
I'm like the Penguin.
He's
from
far
Batman.
From it. You're far from a Birdman.
And I don't know why you're called a Snowball, because you're not round.
But I'm white.
We gotta come up with new nicknames. Like I had that idea about you guys combining to form some sort of Voltron-like... character, like you guys mixed together. I know maybe that's too homoerotic, but you know, and then you and then the Oliver Twist with his hat, and then you guys can form together to I don't know what kind of crime you'd fight, but
Sean, what you do in the privacy of your own home is your problem.
That's what
I got a little like Mike Dodd action figure, and then I got a little Snowball, and I go, I'm gonna be this and that. Then I make it mixed together, and that's what I do in my spare time. You guys are so famous.
Wait, we have action figures?
Damn right.
Yeah, I made them. I made them.
Oh, sweet. Can we have pictures?
Yeah.
I am the Stay Puft Marshmallow Man from Ghostbusters.
I took a Ghostbusters doll, and I spray painted it white for Snowball, and then I took like a. The guy from Street Fighter 2. No, I'm kidding.
Thanks, Sean. I love you too.
Well, you said your name was Sumo, so I thought of the Sumo wrestler on
E-Honda.
Street Fighter 2. Yeah, E-Honda. So I took an E-Honda guy, and then I put some glasses on him. You wear glasses, right?
I do.
And then I put an anime style shirt on him, and then I took a hot glue gun, and then I glued them together in some kind of robot mech warrior type pose, and then you guys fight. I don't know what kind of crime you fight. But.
This is scary. I don't know whether to believe you or not.
I can actually see this in my mind.
This too.
That's incredible.
Well, I'm an actor. I'm an actor, so I'm like, you know, totally lying. No.
That's why we like you, Sean. You're always a lively interview.
I don't typically like... I mean, I'm an actor, but I don't like them. I guess that includes my own self-loathing. Who knows? Although I have actor friends who I like, but most of my experience with actors is while they're very well-meaning people, there's a lot of cliches that are true. I'll just say that much.
Oh, wow.
Well, what's really the difference between regular voice actors and just actors?
Voice actors typically are actors. I mean, I don't think there's really much difference. It's all acting. Voice actors will only do voice. Those are typically voice over guys who are usually radio and radio spot guys, or commercial guys, and they are acting in a way that's definitely a style of acting, but they are typically, from my experience, not people who do a lot of other acting. And voice actors are typically people who actually do act either on camera or on stage. So I don't really think there's much difference. Now, there's definitely a difference between voice acting and acting. The spiritual, psychological things are the same, but the difference is you're only using your voice and very little body movement versus using your whole body as an instrument to express a character. So there's definitely those differences, but that's not, I don't think, what you guys wanted to talk to me about, or is it? I don't know.
Well, actually, gonna say, like, there was one thing I kind of wanted to know about voice actors. Now, I know from hearing a lot of interviews from voice actors that they usually do use a lot of body movement when they're actually acting to kind of get a certain actual voice. Like, do you do that with any of your stuff?
They might be doing that before voice, but those voice actors are lying, because one, I've directed a bunch of them, and they can't move like that in the booth, otherwise you'll pick it up sound-wise. So I know that I know what they're saying. They're not, the differentiation I'm making is that they're not using the same amount of physical movement they use on stage, because it would be picked up by the microphone. They may move a little bit in the booth, and there may be some things that get expressed while they're acting, but if there's you know how mics are picky, I mean they pick up a lot of audio, If they move too much, you'll pick it up. So there have been actors who do move a lot that I've had to say, you can't move while you're doing that, because I'm picking it up, you know. And I have been guilty of that. The other day I was in a session, and I did not take the cloth noise because I was moving while I was in the booth. I was acting. Yeah, there's a tendency to do that.
Hmm. So do you have to kind of restrain yourself when you're voice acting?
You do. You have to restrain yourself a little bit, but when you do enough voice acting, it never feels like a restraint after a while. After a while, you just know that you're in the booth, and you just know, you know, it's not a big deal. At least for me, it's not, you know.
Hmm.
So if I did a Kamehame gesture every time I did the Kamehameha, I would have knocked over several mic stands, you know, or something with just moving my hands like that. So I think there's a lot of, like, pseudo-movements, like subtle gestures that symbolize a larger gesture that I see actors do, you know, like very subtly shaking their fist if they're a bad guy, you know. Say, you know, I'll see subtle things like that, but nothing that's too big, otherwise you got to re-record it.
Hmm. All right, Sean, well, one of the things we want to cover today during this interview is, during our research period for this, there isn't a lot of
Wait a second. During our research, what?
Well, basically, we wanted to find out more about you to ask more in-depth questions. There's not a lot.
Right, but what'd you say? I just didn't hear what you said. What was the word you said? You said research what?
Your autobiographical background. Basically, looking into you as a person.
Oh.
There's not a lot out there.
Oh.
So one of the purposes of this interview is to get to know you as a person, because there isn't a lot of info out there.
Yeah, I tend to be a pretty private person, largely because my life has been extremely interesting, and I'm saving it for my biography I'm going to write, or was it autobiography? Which one's the one when you yourself write it?
Autobiography.
Autobiography, right. I don't understand why it's auto. I don't know if it's automatic. I don't know where the Latin root comes from. I kind of like etymology, and I'm surprised I don't know why that is that way. But I'm saving it for my autobiography, so I thought about, like, editing my Wikipedia page and putting my whole life history on there, but I thought, no, I've had a very interesting life, and I'm going to save it. But I will answer some questions in regards to that if you have some things you want to talk about.
Well, Steve, give your usual spiel, as you
will. Well, obviously, like a lot of interviews we do, we like to do, like, kind of an inside-the-actor-studio-type interview. So the first question I'm going to ask...
You're going to have to be a lot more pretentious before you do that.
Well, we have the wonderful, the amazing, the ever-so-awesome Sean Schimmel on the line.
Yeah. I mean, I love George Lipton, right?
James Lipton,
name,
yeah.
Right? Lipton,
yeah.
James Lipton, sorry. I get his name confused. I love him, and I loved it when Will Ferrell was doing an impression of him to his face. That might have been Will Ferrell's most brilliant piece of work. I was to do it right to his face, and then Lipton got out a stack of cards, and then Will Ferrell got out a stack of cards, and the card stack kept getting higher and higher, and Will Ferrell got out this huge, giant stack of cards that was way bigger. It was awesome. It was so... I can't say how much I enjoyed that.
I love those sketches that he does.
I think it's because I'm a big fan of doing impersonations of people, and oftentimes I will do impersonations of people to their face. So as I don't know if I did it to you guys yet, but I did make fun of you, and I didn't mean that in a mean way, certainly. But I do like to tease. I think I grew up around a teasing environment. But tell me what you were going to say. I'm sorry, Mr.
Oh, that's okay. See, now Snowflake is my brother, so that's all right. Oh. So chip off the old snowball. Anyway, what I wanted to ask was, where did you grow up, and where did this whole kind of the childhood of yours start?
And my mother was a single mother, and she had two children at the time, my older brother and myself. And I didn't really have a father until I was about four or five, around four, I think, where my dad married my mother, and, well, he married her later, but he started dating her. And then when I say my dad, my adopted father, but I call him my dad. That's the reason my last name is Schemmel. I'm not really German in any way, shape, or form, and but he married my mother and adopted me and my brother, and then they proceeded to have two more children together, who are my sisters, who I love dearly, who are now adults, of course, and they got divorced when I was in high school, and I still consider both of them, of course, my parents, and I'm going home to Texas, and I will visit, you know, my parents when I'm down there, even though they're no longer married. But then we moved. I lived in Iowa until I was, we lived on a farm briefly, and that was actually hugely influential in my life. And then we moved to a small town called Eagle Grove, and I lived there for a couple of years. And then we moved to Texas when I was, my dad's a minister, and he had two choices for his first mission call. When you graduate from seminary, you get what's called a call, and a call has a spiritual meaning. It also has a legitimate, you know, not legitimate, but a real-world meaning that you get an actual phone call from a church that says, we would like to interview you to be our pastor. And he had two choices, and one was to go to Texas, and the other one was to go to China. Now, at the time, I wanted to go to China because I thought it would be really cool, but my only concern was, you know, I asked two questions. I'm like, you know, are the girls cute, and
will they like me?
And do they have pictures was the other question. Sorry, someone's calling me, and I'm going to ignore the phone call. Let me ignore that phone call. So my mom did not want to go to China. I think her exact words were, we're not going to effing China, Franz. Franz is my name. Franz is my dad's name. So it's like, I think that words I overheard, we're not going to effing China, Franz. And I was like, oh, man, China would be awesome. But then I also like the idea because I think at the time that show with Dallas was really popular, and so the whole Texas Yeehaw thing was really exciting to me. And we moved to a town called Odessa, Texas. Now, here's the interesting thing: the television series Friday Night Lights and the movie from which it spawned is based on Odessa, Texas, when the football thing was really crazy there. Now, when that movie was shot, the time period in which that movie was shot, I lived there during that time and experienced that football cult phenomenon. I played football in junior high school on the west side, which is the Odessa High School, and the big winning football team was the Permian Panthers, and they were on the other side of town, the east side of town. The west side wasn't poor, but it was poorer than the east side of town. Again, there was a lot of money in that town because of oil. And I experienced that whole cult football phenomenon while it was happening. My brother briefly went to Permian, and my girlfriend went to Permian High School. And I played football for a team that fed into a junior high school that fed into the Odessa High School football scene. And one of the reasons I got such a good music education was because football was so popular and so powerful in Odessa that you can't have a good football team without a good marching band. So they imported... They had a lot of money for band instruments because of the oil, and they had a lot of money to build nice schools and to import really good band directors. So I got a really great music. I said music, which is funny because there's a show I work on called Chaotic where they have a thing called music, so I think my brain is frying. But I had a really good music education because of football, and I did play up until end of junior, well, part of junior high, and then I decided that the crazy cult football thing was so hardcore. And by the way, that movie, I don't know if the events of that movie are true, but the fundamental culty-like nature of that, it was, in my opinion, all true. I mean, it's insane out there. I don't know if it is to this day, but in the 80s, oh my God. Well, it was actually 83, 85 I lived in Odessa. And then I moved to Fort Worth, Texas, Dallas, Texas, Dallas area, and then I went to high school there, graduated, and then I went to college at the University of North Texas, or North Texas State University at the time. So that is the short version of my life. I'm skipping a bunch of stuff, but if there's anything else you want to ask about it, sure, we can talk.
That's okay. Actually, well, one question I was going to ask is, are you any person in your family kind of in the creative arts sort of realm? Like, are they kind of fall into your footsteps?
Well, here's the interesting thing about it is my biological father went on to have a family of his own, and he has three children whom I become friends with after I discovered I had a biological father when I was 25. And my half-brother Tony Enslow, which is my birth name, Enslow, he lives in Boston, and he was a professional trombone player. Now, I was a professional French horn player, and I almost played trombone. So he was a brass player. He has a classical music background as I do. We have the same favorite band, which is Rush, Love Canada.
Awesome.
My other half-brother, Chris, he lives in Utah. He ended up playing drums, is also a huge Rush fan, and which is interesting that we all have the same favorite band. I have another half-sibling named Libby, who's a PE coach, I believe, at a public school, I believe, in Wichita, Kansas. And then my older brother, who is the only sibling I have who's 100% genetic related, he's a guitar player. And he kind of plays, you know, he's kind of introverted, so he plays, he doesn't play in a band, he plays for himself, and we talk about guitar stuff, and we play together sometimes, but he's in the food service industry, and but he's actually really quite talented, and if he wanted to play in public, I think he'd do really well. And then I have a sister, my youngest sister Jessica graduated from Columbia Barnard with a degree in choir and singing, and she conducts my dad's choir, and then also, because my dad's a minister, and then she also conducts choir for a public school in Texas. So she's a choir director. And then my other sister Rachel plays guitar and sings, and she actually, for fun, sang on the streets of San Francisco for fun, singing folk songs and stuff, and she's quite talented, although she's a teacher in New Jersey. But she's very musically talented as well. So the whole family, my dad always wants us to get together and have some kind of Von Trapp family singers type of thing. And when I do go home for Christmas, we are required to sing impromptu choir songs in four-part harmony, which we all do quite well, I'm very happy to say. Sometimes in the middle of the IHOP parking lot, my dad's kind of a charismatic. Well, his favorite thing to do is to, he likes to come to town. When we come to town, Lutherans have a tradition where they have what's called a candlelight service before Christmas Day. And so it's a service they have from 11 to 12. And then after that, my dad likes to go take the whole family to IHOP. And then he doesn't really order much food because he's going to eat off all our plates and we're done. And the whole family's there. And then he makes us stand out in the parking lot and sing carols at, you know, 1, 2, 3 in the morning. And then we go back and sing karaoke at his house and stay up late opening presents till 4 or 5 in the morning. Then we all sleep in. And it's kind of a hippie, I wouldn't say hippie, but it's kind of a granola-y kind of, I don't know, it's fun.
Your dad sounds awesome.
Yeah. The only thing I don't like about my dad is that most of my friends and girlfriends like him more than they like me. So I'll bring a girlfriend home. She's like, your dad's awesome. I'm like, what about me? Hello? Or, you know, my male friends will come over and they're like, man, your dad's awesome. Like, I'd like to be awesome too. So that would be the only thing I can say bad about my dad is that he's a lot of fun and a really good minister. Though I myself am not Christian, but he is a really good, if I were going to be, I do like his message quite a bit. So anyway, but yeah, that's kind of a nutshell of what Christmas is going to be like with the Shemmels.
That's awesome.
That is intense.
If you guys were in town, he'd invite you over for dinner. Like, he will, a lot of times.
That would be so cool.
Many people will come over.
All right, we're buying tickets to go to Texas right now.
He'd say, bring him along. It's okay. He'd be totally cool with it. I'd probably be thoroughly annoyed. Not that I don't like you guys, but I get annoyed when there's more people there than just family sometimes because I kind of want to spend the time with family, but he's so super Christian and inviting, which I think is a great trait to have. He will invite everybody over, and I think that's really sweet, but, you know, my selfishness kicks in, and I'm just like, what about time for, you know, I mean, we bust while we're private? So while I understand where he's coming from, I'm also like, I want to just have the family. So maybe I'm...
See, what you don't realize is that is the fact that after this interview, we will become like family. So
yeah. Exactly. Well, then I'll have to show you the actual doll I made of you guys hot glued together. No, I'm kidding.
Sweet.
That would be really cool if you actually did do that. I would have said you something remarkably cool.
It would be really creepy, too. Maybe I should do that. I should just go buy an E-Honda action figure and then a Ghostbuster and spray paint in white and then just glue it together and mail it to you. It's all half-assed, gooey, kind of weird thing. That would be so creepy. It's
stuck
funny.
To the bubble wrap.
That would be...
I wonder what customs would say if they saw that.
Yeah, they'd be like, what is this? Yeah.
It's Snowball Birdman, don't you know? Yeah.
It's that Sean Schemmel character. He sends weird stuff out to people.
Pretty soon he's going to start sending out spam. I don't know.
But yeah, so I don't know, Snowball. Let me see. What else can we ask Sean? All right, so now we know about a little bit about your family background, what you're like as a person around your family, which is really cool. Actually, I don't know. I never would have got that impression that you come from this kind of a background. But then again, even only spending 15 minutes with you at the Fan Expo this year, I don't know. I kind of had a feeling you were this really friendly person. Now, what are some of your friends like? Basically, like, what do you guys like to go out and do?
Well, the interesting thing is I'm a lay student of psychology. And one thing I've discovered is me and my best friend Ralph and my other best friend Brian, who's my two buddies from Texas, we all have very similar mothers, and I don't want to go into that because that's a little too private, but our parenting, at least on our mothers, and I've always asked my friend Ralph, I was like, are we, you know, friends because we had very similar, we were raised by very similar mothers? A lot of people think I'm like, it's really funny because I have this persona that comes across at conventions that, which I do on purpose because I want to entertain fans and I want people to enjoy, you know, coming to meet me because they go to a lot of effort to come to meet me, and I'm actually rather humbled by it. I'm actually a pretty serious guy, and I spend a lot of time. I have a lot of existential angst, and I read a lot of philosophy books, and I'm serious, but I also spend a lot of time having. It's a mixture of seriousness and fun, as I usually vacillate between the two. So, you know, my friends will call me up and like, what crazy fun thing are you doing? I said, I'm just in my apartment playing my electric guitar really loud. Or, you know, then I'll call Ralph, who, you know, is a real science genius and talk about the, you know, nature of the universe. Or I have a friend named Leonard in Texas. He's also a very old, very close friend of mine. And he just sent me a whole thing about this new paradigm that they're trying to say about science with the universe and the sun being largely electrical versus gravitationally based. And I've been reading about that. I read a lot of Buddhist literature, and I used to read a lot of sci-fi fantasy novels. And I spend a lot of time staring at the ceiling because when I'm out in public, I do everything is so high energy, I need a lot of downtime. And I play my horn a lot, and I write music about, the music I write tends to be very serious. So as much fun as I like to have, I guess I'm known in voiceover as a guy who cracks a joke and is really funny. In my private life, I'm actually very quiet and pretty serious, which I never really realized until I was sitting around by myself once going, I'm really quiet and serious.
That's actually kind of cool because the fact that you kind of take that time and you distinguish each other from your private life and your public life. That's pretty cool.
I'm an extremely introspective person, probably to a fault. Like many of my friends say, Sean, you'll do a lot better once you get out of your own way. I tend to get in my own way a little bit in terms of real hardcore self-examination and psychological. I read a lot of psychology books too. The human behavior and social behavior, I don't know if it's because I was raised by a minister and a social worker, or my sister has a degree in psychology, or what reason, but it's interesting. In fact, the other day I was talking to my friend Ralph about a cartoon. I was like, he's an animator and also a science guy. He was working on a doctorate in biology, and now he wants to be an animator. He's actually quite good. And he does a lot of business-to-business animations for companies and presentations in 3D and using Lightwave and stuff. But I said, wouldn't it be cool if you made an animation where you people interact and then they have perception and then that perception is filtered by your own experience. So what if that, like I know as I interact with you, there's what you're saying and then there's how I filter and perceive it. And so what if you had like a bunch of characters walking around and wherever they look, you would see the projection of what their perception was projected on a wall. So that would change how you would view the world. Do you see what I'm saying? Like, So use the metaphor, Snowball would not be albino on a different planet with different light. It's only because that particular frequency of light is absorbed into his skin because of his own genetic makeup. And so on another planet, he might be a black dude, or he might be, depending on the light frequency. So the idea was is that, to use that as a metaphor for perception, is that my favorite Buddhist quote is, our perceptions carry with them the errors of subjectivity. So there's what you see, there's definitely reality, you know, meaning like objective reality, meaning you and all three of us can look at a stop sign and go, yeah, that's an octagonal red stop sign, but I'm partly colorblind, so the shade of red I see is different than the shade. And then, of course, then you get to artistic subjectivity, where many people will say they like my work, and I meet plenty of fans who like don't like my work, and I have no problem with that because I know that they're experiencing it through their own subjective state, which is valid. So I think about these things a lot. And I hope I didn't offend you.
It's amazing.
Go ahead.
No, it's amazing. I actually understand you very, very, very easily with it, because I'm actually studying a little bit of philosophy right now. And
yeah, same here. I just finished a course in philosophy 2 days ago, actually.
Yeah, so no. I think I like that idea about me being a black man. That's a pretty cool idea.
You know, I like to say I'm black from the waist down, and the ladies really like that. I have no problem with that. Whatsoever.
That's going into the clip show.
Yes, I almost did a spit take. That's awesome.
The quotable Sean Shovel.
You can use that as your quote. You can say, you know, I'm albino, but I'm black from the waist down.
I love that. That's it. I'm doing it. That's awesome.
So I don't know if that's, you know, I had an interesting discussion about racism with some friends of mine recently, and I'm like, well, if I like Asian women, does that mean I'm racist against white women? I mean, what does that mean? Because I don't want to get into a big racial discussion online, but people, I feel like the PC thing has gotten way bent out of shape, that if you observe someone's race or if you observe their skin color, it's all of a sudden racial, versus using it to hurt them or be mean. That's racism, but just to observe someone and to say that, like, I'm a white dude. Actually, technically, I'm Irish and Armenian. I'm a quarter Armenian, I found out. What does that mean? You know, I don't think it. People's perceptions are colored by that, and it's annoying to me that I can't say I was talking to three people, a Mexican guy, a black guy, and a white guy, and all of a sudden I'm a racist. You know, that's just preposterous in my opinion. And like I said, you know, I know a lot of guys who are into Asian women. Does that mean they're racist against white women, or black women for that matter? So it's an interesting subject that you probably discuss at another day, but you know, and I'm sure you have your own unique experiences as an albino. Like one of my close friends, I told you, Victor Ronato is a pretty famous comedian. He's an African American albino, and he has, you know, all the features of an African American, plus he has white skin and white hair, and he uses that in his comedy routine all the time. It's very funny stuff.
Yeah, well, I mean, being an albino kind of growing up, it definitely was very interesting. You get a lot of very interesting stares from different people when you're walking through the mall and stuff like that. But
yeah.
The way I do it as far as racism is concerned, I just say, I'm whitey and I apologize. That's
no, Steve, you went on the radio once and said white power.
No, I said I'm white and I'm proud. Well, what's wrong with that?
No, he said white powder, like the powder. That's what he said.
Yes. No, I love jelly donuts with white powder. That's
powder,
right.
Yeah. Actually, he's not albino. He puts white powder on his skin to confuse people. No, I'm kidding.
That's right. It's all makeup, man. It's all makeup.
That's amazing.
My favorite line that Victor, he opens his comedy routine was, hi, everyone. I'm a black albino. Anyone else? And then he just starts laughing. I love that joke that he did. I think I saw that. He was on Last Comic Standing. And he was in Pluto Nash with Eddie Murphy, and he just shot a film. He's doing really well. He writes, he's a writer, and he was writing a video game I'm working on for, it's going to be released on PS3. It's called Rat Race, and right now it's tentatively titled Rat Race, and I'm real excited about it because I can't talk a lot about it, but it's going to be a kind of a game that's similar to The Sims, but it's not really a sim, and it's a living situational comedy to where you're trying to climb this corporate ladder, et cetera, et cetera. And I play a couple voices on it, and it's going to be the excuse I have to buy a PS3 because I've been working on the game for a couple of years. There's a lot of dialogue, and I saw a working build of it the other day, and it looks great. And the company I work with it's called Super Ego Games, and they're coming. They're an up-and-coming video game company. And he writes for that. Him and a guy named Roger Hales, and I believe another writer, They have another whole writing staff are writing that game. And it's a comedy. It's essentially a situation comedy that you're playing the game in a corporate office. And I play a very heavy set guy named Steve Middleman, and I play another guy named Vlad, who's a kind of a, not a Borat parody. I mean, people are going to have it come across that way, but he's from an Eastern Bloc country, and he's trying to make it in business in this video game environment. But it's a very funny video game. Anyway, I digress.
That's actually a rather remarkable idea for a game. I never would have thought of a situational comedy as a video game.
Yeah, and it's really cool. Yeah, so I'm very excited about it.
And as you said, a reason to buy a PlayStation 3 because there's a million of them sitting on shelves.
I love the fact that we went from philosophy to racism to PS3.
You know, I will play my French horn and then play guitar, then read a book about philosophy, and then I'll get online and play 360 and blow up a bunch of crap and enjoy the basic, you know, caveman. I think for me, philosophy-wise, and this is where, you know, the interesting thing about being, you're trying to be self-aware is, I have a hard time dating for this reason, is that I am keenly aware of mankind's caveman tendencies. I also know that I'm not above them, that I too am a caveman. So, you know, I will make fun of myself where, you know, as I observe a party and I can see the alpha male and I can see women competing and I can watch the Wheels of Power, et cetera, et cetera. And I'm not saying that I'm better than that or above it, but I am saying that I maybe are more aware of it or observe it more than the average person. And, like, I'm reading a book called The 48 Laws of Power by Robert Greene, which is a really interesting book about power. And I think everybody who's in the entertainment business should read it. And if you follow the laws of power, you'll become an unscrupulous cad, which is not what I want to become. But I'm also reading it to protect myself against people who are in power, which as I move into the entertainment business, I find I run into more and more of. And it's dangerous. It's dangerous because you want to be a good guy and move your career along. But not everybody's playing. I think it was Machiavelli or somebody who said that if you're, you know, a nice guy, you will be eaten alive by those who are not.
Well, that sucks for me then.
Yeah, you're a super nice guy.
So it's hard. It's hard to balance that, you know. And Buddhism essentially asks you to not be human on a lot of levels, you know. To not attach with things and not experience, you know, all kinds of. On the most basic level, I think spirituality is. The brain stems the higher brain's functions conflict against the brain stem. In other words, there are two forces fighting, I feel like, in your head. One is your higher brain functions, and the other one is your brain stem, which is like, okay, I want to impregnate every girl I see, and I want to, you know, kill that guy and take his wife, and, you know, all those caveman things that we supposedly have evolved against. And then spirituality is like, no, don't do that. Transcend that and be higher, and don't lust after your this, and don't do that, and which is all, I think, wonderful and noble stuff. And I think the struggle that mankind faces is the battle between those two evolutionary forces, and they manifest themselves in a myriad of ways throughout different religions and different cultures, and even in mythological archetypes throughout history. That's my take on it.
So basically you kind of appeal to the camp of the aesthetic and the ethical kind of combined into one then.
Well, be more specific.
Well, aesthetic, basically the whole pleasure is like, I want to impregnate everybody, and the ethical is like, you probably shouldn't be doing that.
So basically
I don't necessarily look at it as aesthetic. I think that being aware of that, like, I don't deny, I mean, this is where when I, you know, especially as I date, where women and men, when I hear women complain about men, and I think the reason people freak out when they get married is because, and I've been married, and the reason you freak out when you walk down the aisle is because as a man, your brain is walking down the aisle and is overriding your biology and saying, I am going to have sex with only this person the rest of my life. Now, while that may be a very pleasing concept on a lot of levels, your subconscious is probably going, wait a second, you are cutting off all other chances of genetic survival. And so I think that one of the reasons people flip out, and women are doing the same thing, but in a different way. So I think that we have a layer of what's superimposed, you know, civility over what's going on. I don't know, the aesthetic, I don't know if you know, I never really thought of it being put that way, but I guess what I'm saying is that I think this is the reason people freak out. And when you hear women complain about what they don't like about men, it is our very biological caveman nature. And I think men feel unappreciated sometimes because they're like, does she know the sheer number of women I'm not having sex with just to be with her? I feel like that deserves some darn credit.
I wholeheartedly
agree. Sean, I like you.
You see what I'm saying? And I don't think either camp is right. Like, I view like a lot of women like Sex in the City as a TV show. And my argument of that is that Sex in the City is just as bad as the man show if for women. I call it the man show for women. The man show was girls bouncing on trampolines and bikinis and guys being pigs and drinking beer. The Sex in the City is a bunch of women having indiscriminate sex with a bunch of other men and talking about it and which flavor of the month they like or whatnot. And I watched enough episodes to realize that. And it indulges their caveman tendency. And so men are like, they're not doing anything worse than men is what I'm saying. I'm just saying if they act like it's anything different, it's a more, definitely a better show and more well-written and definitely more. And they're like, well, that's not relationships. Well, yeah, later after all that stuff, sure. But I call it the man show for women because it is every woman's caveman fantasy to, you know, and you'll hear them talk about men in a very objectifying way, which I have no problem with because men are so guilty of objectifying women for so many centuries. And I think the reason men and societies objectify women is because all life springs from women. If you look at an African statue of what is considered the source of life, it'll be like this very fat woman with many, many breasts, and it symbolizes the source of all life, which I think is actually kind of a beautiful thing. But I like to make fun of the girls that like Sex in the City because basically they're expressing their own caveman desires, which is I need to find the caveman premise of women is like I got to find the best genetic person to carry on my line, and the way to do that is to sample a whole lot to figure out which one is going to, you know, be the earn the most income for to appeal to my security, even though I'm an empowered woman. And I've dated a lot of women who have made plenty of money, but still for some reason I have to be secure in my own money for some reason. And I'm like, wait a second, that's just your unconscious nesting or caveman desire, just like my caveman desire when a woman walks in with larger breasts, my subconscious is she's more fertile. And that's not biologically true, actually. But, you know, and I'm being candid about all this stuff because I'm just trying to, you know, I'm not trying to start a fire here, but I'm just, this is how I perceive things, and so it's valid, I guess, in that regard. But, you know, it's so funny that you know, as you watch the women they go through, or the men they go through, I'm sorry, which one is compatible or which one they like and how they talk about it and who they actually end up with, it's interesting paradox to me. I mean, it's paradoxical and comical and very funny. And it makes it extraordinarily difficult for me today because I'm so aware of all this stuff. Unless the girl's on that playing field with me, I'm really just not interested in dating her. Because all that she typically does is function out of either fear or reactionary programming to that. In other words, you know, you have to make X amount of income, you have to be this responsible otherwise. And I'm like, well, that's ridiculous. That's, you know, and not that I'm not responsible for my money, not that I don't make a decent living. I do, but I really don't feel like that's the bottom line for relationships, for long-term relationships, I don't think, unless your whole goal is...
You must have been a philosophy teacher in a previous life or something.
No, I just...
Yeah, Sean, come teach it, now
awesome.
You're
awesome, yeah.
I just spent a lot of my free time thinking about this. And by the way, I'm watching TV with the volume off as I'm talking to you, and William Shatner's on TV advertising for World of Warcraft, and that's so awesome. That they got.
That's an awesome person,
so awesome.
By the way. That and Mr. T.
Although I'm just not into World. I play World of Warcraft, and I play with my friends, but my big issue with World of Warcraft is that I like to control all my movements, so I like Oblivion better. Like, I don't like the auto, like, you know, right-click and you're fighting. I want to swing my sword, you know? And I'm not into the social aspect of it because as much as I like people, I'm in a magical fantasy realm. So when some 15-year-old punk is like, dude, I'm boo-de-boo, and I'm like, you just ruined my suspension of disbelief. And I know they have servers where you're supposed to act like you're in a mystical, magical realm, but none of my friends are on those servers. So I guess I'm contradicting myself a little bit. But, you know, I'm like, on the one hand, I like it, and I think it's a great game, and I do play. But on the other hand, there's some things I'm like running everywhere. It's like, oh, I'm doing about 18 hours of running. Yeah, that's fun. Real fun. Thanks.
I know. I'm in the same way because I don't like – I'm a more solo player when it comes to online
games. Yeah, I'm a solo
games.
Player,
yes.
too.
I don't like playing with other groups.
Yeah, I'm a solo player, too.
So it's like –
Although
it just doesn't make sense because with the whole PvP
thing. Here's the funny thing. My dad was in town. Now, my dad is a very tall German guy, and he's a kind of a hippie, and he's got a ponytail that's kind of graying, and he's got a beard and a mustache, and he's tall, so my dad goes, well, let's play this World of Warcraft game. So I made a character called Reverend Franz, and I made him look almost exactly like him because the options in World of Warcraft, I made him a priest. And I made him have a beard and mustache, and he's got a ponytail. And I'm like, oh, my God. Like, the options were to make him look almost exactly like my dad were so funny, and it looks almost exactly like him. and then I made my friend Ralph. I made a character named Ralph Canepa, except I decided that he was going to be a priest who only fights naked and is going to completely level up using no weapons and no armor, and I'm going to see how far I can take him with no weapons and no armor, using only the power of the Lord. And he said he's a very shy guy, and he was like, he goes, that kind of creeps me out, you made a character named after me. And I go, yeah, it's kind of funny.
The naked fighting priest.
Yeah, naked fighting priest. Only fights naked. I convinced everybody in Stormwind to dance on the statue naked one day, and then I got my friend to take a bunch of pictures of it, and I thought it was really funny to get everybody up there on this. They were standing on the fountain, actually, naked, and then he took a bunch of pictures of it. That was kind of funny. I'm not an exhibitionist, but
oh, you online people!
I'm not an exhibitionist, but I guess I am in World of Warcraft. I'm like, what? If you're going to be an exhibitionist, there's no better place to be than in a video game, I guess.
Now, are you a female or a male character?
I played female characters with other games, and I tried to play a female character with World of Warcraft, and it was just I couldn't do it for some reason. I actually have used female characters in Oblivion and stuff, but for some reason, World of Warcraft, I had a couple of female characters and I deleted them. I have a Draenei priest. No, no, he's not a priest. He's a shaman named Swolenoff. And the reason I named him Swolenoff is because I was trying to make a sexual innuendo, as well as the fact that all the Draenei sound like they have a Russian accent. So I'm like, ew, my name is Swolenoff. So it's like Swollenov. You know, I am swollen off, you know, to make a double entendre. So I have a lot of funny different names, some of which I won't. I just like to make. Oh, wait, my phone. Hang on a second. Guys, I got to go in my bedroom because my phone is running out of battery power. I need to charge it. What were we talking about? Do you have another question? I don't know. I'm digressing big time.
Oh, that's okay. Like, we're just having fun. So if you want to go change your phone, me and Snowball can ad-lib. Like,
no, it's okay. I'm just walking into my bedroom and plugging in my phone while I'm talking to you.
Okay. Oh, okay. So, yeah. So what other games do you – like, I would never have pegged you for a gamer, Sean, ever.
Oh, actually, I would say that in college, I've been playing video games since they came out, and I would say that I was an addict. When I worked for Software Etc. for 2 years – they had a policy where you could play test the game every night. You could take them a game, unshrink wrap it, play it, and then take it back. And I was in college, and I worked there for 2 years. I play tested over 400 games. And I would say in college I was a bit of an addict to the point where I had to sell my PS1. And at one point I owned every system. Right now I got rid of my – I had an Xbox. I've owned every system, I think. And I just got rid of my Xbox to my brother-in-law, and I have a 360 DS and a GameCube. I got rid of my PSP because it was just gathering dust. There wasn't any good games out for it.
Yeah, because no one plays it.
Yeah, and everybody's like,
I still play it. Come on.
I'm not a big PS. I think DS is better, but I don't have a Wii yet because I haven't seen a game out there that's really compelling, and I don't have a PS3 that I haven't seen because I'm so picky. Like, I will only buy games from I'll only buy games that get 8.0 or higher on IGN.com. I own all the very best games for Xbox 360. But the good thing is that I was a hardcore gamer, but now as I'm older, I can really walk away from games. I'm not an addict anymore. I won't sit there and play World of Warcraft and get divorced over it. I'm not married, but, you know, I would never do that. And I'm not, you know, I don't play for crazy hours online anymore. And I used to, but I can walk away from it now. It's not, I think it's because I'm seeing through the gaming illusion a lot clearer now. So I do enjoy games quite a bit, but...
Now, are you on Xbox Live?
Yeah, I am. I had a... My screen name used to be I'm going to tell everybody, and then if people ask me, want to be my friend, but I don't really care because I'll just say no. But
well, you could tell us off air if you want.
Well, yeah, I'll tell you, I wouldn't mind having you as a friend.
I don't care. No, that's cool. I don't care if people. I'll just say if you're not my friend, I'm not going to add you. If you like Dragon Ball Z, I appreciate it, but that doesn't make us friends. and you know, friends means we do stuff. So hang out and stuff. But I know you guys or whatever. But my original screen name was Goku Box, but then people kept figuring it out and kept contacting me, so I changed it to Kakaos. And what that's based on is when KG and Tenacious D, when Tenacious D does the inward singing thing, and you know inward singing on their record.
Oh yeah, so
he's inward singing, and he's like going. And then I got the lyrics, and you can't believe I'm singing. And I'm never fucking stopping, and you always fucking. You know, so he does it. He goes, I can do that all fucking night. And then KG goes, well, it really wasn't nonstop. And he goes, oh fuck you, it is nonstop. You fucking dick, shut up. You always naysay, and he curses him out. And then at some point, he goes, cock ass, and he says cock ass in a way that's so funny, like it sounds like it's. Kokayuss. So I named my character Kakayus. My gamer tag is Kakayus. So that it's really Tenacious. I mean, Jack Black telling KG, just calling him a cockass, but he's saying it with such a funny inflection. I found that to be extremely funny. So my gamer tag is Kokayuss. But I will tell you, if you're a random person out there and you're going to contact me and go, hey, let's be friends, as much as I love that and appreciate it, I typically do not add people to be friends online unless I really know you or we've met, because it just is so many people and I just can't do it. I say, like on my Facebook, I don't add people on Facebook unless they're actually my friend. But on MySpace, I will add people. I do have a fan site for MySpace. Because then, I do really appreciate all the kids out there who watch, but then they start asking me questions about DBZ that I just simply don't know the answers to, and they ask me insider questions about Funimation that I just don't, it's not really a friendship, it's just, hey, I'm cool.
Them asking questions, more or less.
Yeah, and it's sort of again, like, hey, I'm cool because I know Goku, and while I think it's cool that you think that's cool, that's a pretty one-sided friendship.
Yeah.
So,
yes.
So that's why I don't do it, and I don't want to sound like a jerk, but that's you know, but if you guys contact me or whatever, and that's fine. We can game online. I game with some guy from England that I just met randomly, and I game with guys from Australia. And I don't do it a lot though. I like Rainbow Six; it's pretty fun.
Vegas,
although I think
right?
It's funny that a guy named Vegas. Yeah, I think it's so funny. A friend of mine pointed this out, that this elite team of fighters, guys who spend a lot of time together, are named Rainbow Six. He said he couldn't. He said, "Is that could be like the gayest name you could possibly come up with for a bunch of guys who hang out and infiltrate and shoot guns." And I never dawned on me until he said that. I was like, "Yeah, it is kind of a, and not that there's anything wrong with that, but it's like it changes. What kind of camouflage are you wearing today? Oh, I don't know. What kind of camouflage,
I never thought about that before.
Tom Clancy somewhere shaking his head.
Yeah, going, why did I say rainbow? I don't know. So
what other games do you play online?
I have the Orange Box, which is awesome.
Oh, how do you love Portal?
Portal player, aren't you, Sean?
I am not. My friend Pete Rustica, who's a famous voice actor in his own right and is a very talented man. He is a Portal player, and I think it's because I haven't read the instructions that I haven't figured out how to play Portal yet, because I'm too busy worrying about it. I finished the first chapter, and I'm on episode one. I finished the first incarnation, and I'm trying to finish episode one, and I screwed around with Portal a little bit, and I didn't read the instructions, so I'm like, what do you do? So as soon as I figure it out, I probably will be addicted to Portal. But I hadn't sat down. And what are you? Isn't it you're doing a bunch of puzzle solving?
Yeah, in a way, you're using your portal gun to be able to kind of
move stuff
and be able to move yourself into different areas that you can't. So you have to kind of do that in the whole puzzle aspect. And apparently it's a short game, but it's really fun from what I've played with.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. So I will probably get into that. I bought a new electric guitar, so I might be playing my guitar a lot too. I've been rocking out when I have an amplifier, and so I've been doing that and recording, and I also perform my horn live over the weekend, so I've been practicing music a lot and not playing games, although I'm about to get back into it. I'm a big Oblivion fan, and I have Gears of War, and I like it, but I just never got past the first chapter. I was like, I'm not digging this as much as everybody else
is. Yeah, same here.
I absolutely dude, I can say without question, as a very experienced gamer, that BioShock is one of the greatest games ever made in video game history.
Totally agree.
I am, and the reason I can say that without question, because there are many elements of video games that have been evolving over the last few decades, and all of the elements that, like, you know, first of all, we had graphics and crappy sound, so then the graphics got better, and then, okay, then at some point the sound got better, and then they started adding voices, and they sucked, and then the voices got better, and then all these things came together, and then there was storyline, and then there was that technology to get better. BioShock is the first game, I think, where all the elements of gameplay came together flawlessly. And I don't care if it doesn't have multiplayer, because I don't think that's a big deal. And everybody's, oh, multiplayer this, multiplayer that, multiplayer can suck my balls. I don't care. if a game doesn't have multiplayer, it doesn't mean it's a crappy game. That just is so annoying. What happened to the solo quest of story where you're on your own? I like that. So I'm not going to knock down BioShock at all for lack of multiplayer. I don't care. The voice acting, as a professional voice actor, in my opinion, BioShock's voice acting is absolutely stellar. It is some of the best voice acting, if not the best voice acting I've ever heard on any video game.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. My hat's off to the cast and the director. I haven't read the credits. I finished the game, but I refuse to kill the last bad guy because I'm afraid for it to be over. I'm a big fan of 1920s and 50s style voices. The macabre aspect of the Ayn Randian influence, and the Americana archetypal subconscious it pulls on when you all those elements coming together to make a really creepy game. The AI is brilliant. The weapon choices are creative. The story is believable. The comedy aspects there. The American history is there in a way. And I know you guys can appreciate too, as Canadians, but that whole Andrew Lloyd Wright. Frank Lloyd Wright, sorry, I'm thinking of Andrew Lloyd Webber and Frank Lloyd Wright stuck together. Frank Lloyd Wright influence, and I don't know if you know this, but Frank Lloyd Wright had his own creepy tragedy in his life. He had a servant, somebody who light his house on fire and murder a bunch of his family members early in his career. So there's all kind of that. Well, I knew that about Frank Lloyd Wright, and the Art Deco always comes across as creepy, and the mixture, and that cusp in American science where we were, that's so much hubris, and knew enough about science to be really dangerous. I mean, we're just now in 2007 discovering that a lot of the science that we were using in the 50s was just flat out dangerous. You know, that whole cusp of that mixture of it is just fantastic. I can't say enough good things about BioShock. One of the great, I would say the best game I played this century, because I don't know about last century, but the very best game I played, possibly the best game I've ever played in my life.
Wow.
That's my BioShock review.
I mean, I'm going to have to buy that.
And,
yes. One of the things...
Dude, if you...
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
No, I'm done. Okay. I was just going to be redundant.
Oh,
probably.
One of my favorite jokes about it is the fact that it's like, yeah, you got mutants and playing in a town that's basically totally run down. Congratulations, Detroit. You're a game.
What's that?
It's
again,
like, congratulations,
what?
Detroit. You're a game.
Yeah, it's kind of like, no, I get to see that. What I like is that it's underwater, this underwater thing, and that opening theme where you just you open up and you're all of a sudden you're like, what? It is just so unbelievable in so many ways. I just it was my jaw dropped when I played the demo, and I'm a kind of a ho hum gamer. Like I'm like, yeah, whatever. And I was just my jaw dropped when I played this game. When I went to a convention at. Was it? Wait, what convention was I? I was invited to a convention near Portland. I want to remember the name of the convention because I go to so many and they were so good to me and I don't want to screw this up by not remembering the name of the convention. It was not Katsucon. It was, oh crap, I can't remember. And I feel bad because here I am being recorded and I cannot remember it off the top of my head. But I was so into the game at the time, I asked them to bring an Xbox 360 and BioShock into the green room. And what blew me away was that they did. So they brought in a 360 and BioShock. Hey, I'm going to find out which convention this is so I can give you the proper name and give them props. So anyway, next question. What do you want to talk about?
Wow. Well, there's just so much. I'm trying to think here. I guess we should move it up to Dragon Ball Z, obviously. Now, sure.
Kumori-kan. Wait, that was Kumori-kan. That's where I went to.
Awesome.
Kumori-kan. K-U-M-O-R-I-C-O-N. That's where I went. And they treated me really well. And they were awesome. Anyway, so Dragon Ball Z, yes.
Now, because we've learned in this interview of your huge philosophical background, what do you feel is the biggest influence philosophically that series has had on the American anime?
Hi, it's Jamie, Progressive's Employee of the Month, 2 months in a row. Leave a message at the... Hi, Jamie. It's me, Jamie. I just had a new idea for our song about the Name Your Price tool. So when it's like, tell us what you want to pay, hey, 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 and the trombone goes, blah, 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 and you say, we'll help you find coverage options to fit your budget. Then we just all do finger snaps while a choir goes, savings coming at ya, savings coming at ya. Yes? No? Maybe? Anyway, see you at practice tonight. I got new lyrics for the rap break.
Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
The internet can be your window to the world. Or an open door that lets cyber criminals in. Online theft, webcam spying, and identity fraud are all on the rise. But you can stay safe with Kaspersky Lab, the world's most awarded internet security. Kaspersky protects your money, privacy, identity, and data with technology perfected over 20 years. So keep exploring. Kaspersky Lab will keep you safe online. Learn more at Kaspersky.com.
Culture, so to speak. Like, what do you think it has imparted to children of this generation?
Well, that's a question I need to address with some history first. I met Wendy Pinney at one of my first anime conventions, creator of ElfQuest, and she said, you're the voice of Goku, right? And she goes, and she's a very spiritual person, and she's like, you understand, like, you have an enormous responsibility with this role. This is the story of the Monkey King and the Great Journey West. It's an ancient Asian story that's being retold in this kind of sci-fi martial arts environment, and I want to talk to you about what your role is in this character. And it's, and she believed it was no accident that I got the part. And ironically enough, I was born in the year of the monkey, and Goku turns into a big monkey, so I am a monkey in the Chinese calendar. I don't know what spiritual significance that has, but Dragon Ball Z is, from what I understand, a retelling of this the Monkey King and Hanuman and the Great Journey West, which is basically what Joseph Campbell talks about in his Hero and the Myth and Hero of a Thousand Masks, a Thousand Faces. And the question is, what influence does it have on this generation? Oh, God. You know, Dragon Ball Z has had more of an influence on... I mean, I think there are two shows that really broke open the door for anime and pop mainstream anime in America. And one is Pokemon, which I had worked on, and I know most of that cast. In fact, not I know the whole cast, and they're a great bunch of people. It's been a real privilege to be able to work with them and on them. And I've learned a lot about acting and voice acting from many of them, including Veronica Taylor. And Dragon Ball Z were huge in busting this door open. I mean, Dragon Ball Z is so laden with fights that last for 2 weeks, a lot of times I think people miss the underlying points. And you can see elements of Taoism. I mean, for Christ's sake, listen to me. I say for Christ's sake, look at how much Christianity has permeated our language. But I say for Christ's sake, or some say for Pete's sake, and they mean St. Peter or whatever. It's all, religion and culture, it's all intertwined. But, for whatever's sake, there's a scene where Gohan is teaching Videl, I believe, how to make a ball of chi in her hand, chi energy, life energy in her hand. So there's massive Chinese, Taoist, Shinto references in it, Buddhist references in it. Christians could argue that there are some kind of, sacrificial references Goku makes when he, sacrifices himself with the at the end of Dragon Ball Z. What I think is great about it is the kids that it affects, the kids I meet who... especially, it's usually teenage boys, and I think I can relate to them because I was a very sensitive and very intelligent and very intense young teenager, and there are these, I don't want to use the word lonely teenage boys, but there are teenage boys out there in particular who are trying to find their empowerment as a man as they make that transition from teen boy to man. And puberty can be rough, and it's very troublesome, and you feel that teen angst and that existential. And I think for there's this glow that these teenage boys have when they meet me in their eye, like of awesomeness. Like being a teenager sucks, but when I watch Dragon Ball Z, I feel awesome. And your voice has made me feel, your interpretation of the role has made me feel awesome. It's kind of a, I'm trying to put my finger on it, but there's a certain vibe they have where they're talking, and
it's like, you know, I don't have good social skills, or I'm into my martial arts club and I'm considered a nerd or a geek, but, you know, Dragon Ball Z makes me feel cool, or Dragon Ball Z makes me feel accepted, or Dragon Ball Z makes me feel empowered. I noticed that there are a lot of cultures that are not as empowered, say, as white culture that are really into Dragon Ball Z. And I don't want to pick on anybody, but a lot of Hispanic kids like Dragon Ball Z, and a lot of African-American kids like more. So I have more kids who come up to me culturally who are from different ethnic groups who are, you know, disadvantaged or poor because of whatever reason, and they feel empowered by that. And I think that's freaking awesome. I knew a guy who, you know, his favorite time was to watch Dragon Ball Z with his brother. And then his brother went to the Iraq War and died. So for him, Dragon Ball Z is this memory of, you know, spending this close bonding time with his brother. So, yeah, there's a bunch of violence and there's a bunch of fighting. And there's also a bunch of really, really great stuff. So the influence that it's had, don't be afraid of your, there's this, me and my friend Ralph talk about this inner force in our psyche, in our being, that what it means to be a man, or what it means to be a person, or what it means to be, you know, this force inside. And I think it's about not being afraid of that inside you, or how it influences these kids, and to embrace that, you know. I know I'm talking in very broad terms, and I'm not being specific, but what I'm touching on is not very specific in terms of the look these kids have in their eye when they come to meet me is that, you know, if their lives aren't as happy as they'd like them to be, at least they know that they've got something in their life, or their force, a force in their life that is exciting and inspiring, that gives them, you know, hope to do what they want to do with their lives. Now, I'll segue into, when I get asked to do animation voiceover, when I was in Canada with you guys, they asked me to do a voiceover 1-2-3 class, which I think is dumb, because there are a lot of standard things that I can tell you about voiceover technique, et cetera, and that's all great and fine. But there are things that aren't talked about in voiceover that I wanted to talk about. So I asked the question, how many people want to be a voice actor? And everybody was like raising their hands, yeah. And I was like, do you really want to be a voice actor, or do you want to be awesome? And what it really is that these kids want to be awesome. In other words, watching anime makes them feel good, whether they're feeling lonely or depressed, or maybe they're happy kids, or maybe the parents aren't nice to them, or the kid picked on them at school, but you know, their escape is this, and it makes them feel awesome, and then they want to, I want to be a voice actor, but really they don't. So then I talk to them about the psychology of how to become awesome. And awesome is finding your own self-congruence. So case in point, if you're in law school because your parents want you to be in law school and you don't want to be a lawyer, you're going to be miserable. So finding your own unconscious self-congruence, and how do I do that? Well, a lot of it's experimentation. A lot of it's ignoring what other people are telling you to do and really striking out on your own. And I always like to say that my success as a person in show business is directly proportional to the amount of personal growth I do as a human being. So I don't always work the business as much as I work on myself. Now, you do have to work the business to some degree. But every person I meet a lot of famous actors, and I spend time talking to them, not so much about the business, but about their personal lives, because I try to figure out why, you know, they're attractive, they're intelligent, and they're talented, but so are a lot of people, but some people aren't doing as well. So why are they doing better? And oftentimes I find that a lot of these people have a deep foundation either with their family, or they have a good upbringing, or they have a deep spiritual life, or they faced a lot of adversity and overcame it through a lot of personal growth, and that's why they're able to, and they stuck to their guns. This is why I'm a huge Rush fan. If you watch, and they can be very Ayn Randian, and I actually do disagree with a lot of what Ayn Rand says, but because I do not think there's a total objective reality, because that would be, if there is objective reality, then there definitely is a Christian God or some sort of God, and there definitely, and elitism is definitely okay, and I disagree with both of those things, mm-hmm. You know, particularly elitism. And the jury's out on the objective God. So anyway, I disagree with that. But Rush, in early interviews, somebody asked them, well, so how do you feel about the other bands and what they're doing? And Geddy Lee was like, I don't really give a crap what they're doing. I can't remember his exact words because I don't want to misquote him on Canadian radio. But essentially the message I got from watching the interview was that we're Rush. We do our own thing. We like other bands. But they're not direct. Like, what the music industry is doing does not necessarily influence how we want to take our creative journey. And that was hugely influential. Rush was massively influential on me. And when I was sitting in my room practicing my French horn 2 or 3, 4 hours a day so I can be an all-state horn player, which I was, and so I can be the best musician I could be. I would listen to songs like Marathon and the Power Windows record and the inspirational things about that Neil Peart would write about not giving up and sticking true to your guns and sticking to your own path despite adversity were massively influential on me. So anyway, back to when I was talking about voiceover classes. So yeah, I can talk about voiceover technique and what I do, but what I do is not going to be what you do. It's going to be totally different. So I try to encourage kids who come to my talk to figure out how to find your path and really capitalize on it. And without fail, I can say in my life, every single person I've ever met who's doing what they really love for a living and doing what they want to do for a living, without a doubt, every single person I've met has been happy. And I've met people who aren't doing what they love for a living, and without a doubt, they're almost always miserable. And I watched my grandfather go to a factory for 35 years, pretty much unhappy. And I don't think anybody should have to do that. And some people aren't in a position to do that, and it's sad and it sucks. So, you know, I guess I'm digressing from the question about Dragon Ball Z. I know it's changed my life, and I'm definitely doing what I love because of it. And I'm hoping that if it's a show that gets you excited about something or you get the deeper meanings. I mean, I had a guy come up to me and said, yeah, I watched when I was a kid, and you know, I love the fighting and the muscles, and now I'm, you know, 20-something, and now I'm watching again. There's all kinds of other stuff and layers and, you know, stuff that's going on. I wouldn't say it's the deepest show on earth, but it definitely hits large philosophical themes that are ancient influence, such as the Tao, such as the great Journey West and the Monkey King and all that stuff. So it's interesting how it's all connected. And a little guy named, you know, Akira Toriyama, who just drawn a cartoon a long time ago, has changed so many people's lives, and particularly, in particular, my life. And the cast members I know of Dragon Ball Z, not to mention the Japanese cast, you know. So yeah. There's my long, 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 long answer, which will probably get edited.
Oh, hell no.
Oh, hell no. That was epic.
That's staying in.
So that's my, you know, and I, you know, I'm okay with open debate. I tend to think outside the box, so, you know, people will probably get mad at me for saying what I say about whatever. But, you know, I don't care. I can't.
Actually.
You know, I heard some, yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. Sorry, Sean. Actually, you go with your thought, then I'll go with mine.
No, I didn't have a thought. I was just going to be redundant again, like okay. I tend to be.
Actually, one of the things I was going to say while I was listening to you talk there, I actually have about the same, trying to think, what's the word here?
Philosophy?
Yeah, the same philosophy is that this show has so many layers, and I was watching it a couple days ago just to prepare for this interview, kind of get into it. And I realized how much the show has kind of impacted my life and how it's going to impact my New Year's resolution sort of thing. And
right.
I was listening to your performance there as Goku, and you're talking to Gohan at one point in the first season saying, don't give up, son, or whatever. And that kind of inspired me. And I had this... as my friend David Dennis would call it, an emotional vomit. And I started thinking about my life and my direction, and I kind of looked at your journey as Goku throughout the series, become stronger, become better, become a better fighter, but at the same time be retaining the good-hearted, honest person that you are, and all you want to do is protect people. And I kind of want to redirect my life towards that, because I kind of feel by being in the entertainment industry, as we all are, sometimes we get lost along the way on the quest to power, on the quest to having a better job, a position. And I looked at just the way Goku's journey went, and I'm thinking, you know what, maybe if I can apply some of these things to my life, maybe the good things will just happen. I can avoid this corrupting influence, and
well,
I don't know.
Let me give you a bit of advice,
okay.
If I can.
Yeah.
And I've been studying power lately, and actually I've been studying Oprah Winfrey, and I got issues with Oprah because
everybody does.
I think she's done a lot of good, and I love her for that reason. But at the same time, I think at the end of the day, it's all about Oprah. But and I don't feel, and a lot of times she'll be on TV and going, "Don't we all feel that way?" And I, actually, Oprah, no, I don't feel that way, and no, we don't all feel the same way, and. But the reason I study her is because she's an enormously powerful person.
Mm-hmm.
And as you go down this quest, one of the things that – remember two things. Every organism is exerting their will to power. So you always have these – there's there's always bleeding heart groups that are like, oh, if you have money, you should feel guilty and give it away. Well, they're exerting their wealth of power to get money, so they're trying to do that. Now, I'm not, don't take me the wrong way. I do believe in giving money and doing whatever. But one of the things I've learned about being half adopted and having one parent you know, behave one way and one parent behave another way, and I don't want to be specific, but one thing I learned is that in order to have children, I think you have to be emotionally wealthy and financially wealthy. And financially less, though. You can actually make a dollar go a lot longer. Kids don't need as many pieces of plastic as TV would like to tell you they need. So you can actually raise a child on a lot less money than I think the average American thinks you can raise a child on. But that's not the point. The point is that as you go down this quest where you want to give, one of the things I've learned, because my dad's a minister, I made the habit of giving things away or being too nice or doing whatever and not taking care of myself. You make sure that Mike Dodd is, or whoever you're talking to, is emotionally wealthy to where your cup is full. Because if you're not emotionally wealthy, you do not have the emotional leftover to give. So you got to. So I take, you know, and I learned this from talking with Chris Sabat a lot. He's a guy that really takes care of himself. Now, Chris Sabat, from what I learned to him, and I love this guy, he has his own company down there at Okotron. He takes care of his employees really well. But he takes care of Chris first, because he knows that if he doesn't take care of Chris, I think the best advice I've ever heard is on an airplane. When an emergency mask drops, put it on your, if you're an adult, put it on yourself first and then your kid. In other words, you're useless if you don't take care of yourself first. And Oprah actually preaches this quite a bit. So you have to draw the difference between self-love and selfishness. So I had to figure out in my head, okay, how much do I need before I feel full? And nobody can judge that. If I need a freaking yacht before I feel full, then that's what I need. I can't deny that. If I only need to live in a tiny apartment with a few pieces of electronics gear that are high quality, a couple of French horns and a guitar, which is kind of how I live, that's all I need, then that's all I need. But I made sure that before people started guilting me into giving away money or doing for others first, so that I should be down at the soup shelter helping people right away. Before I do that, which I've done things like that in the past when I was involved in my dad's church, I definitely think those things are important, and I think that they matter, and I think that people should do them. But if you start giving away and start doing at the expense of your own needs or your own health, you will subconsciously develop resentment. You will not take care of yourself, you will not grow as a person, and you will not be ultimately healthy to be healthy other people. So my advice to you is, yes, definitely go down a more spiritual path. Yes, definitely help other people. But take care of Mike first.
Wow.
Because you're not going to be able to help Jack if Mike is not taken care of. Just like if you had a broken arm and you say, I'd like to play on the team, and you decide to play on the team with a broken arm. Well, you didn't take care of Mike, now the team's going to lose. Because Mike decided he was going to be a charitable player and play rugby or football or whatever you guys play in Canada.
It's all curling, Sean.
You know, and curling, yeah. Which I love curling because they have to sweep fast. You know, I don't understand that, but you got to sweep fast. We got to keep this apartment clean quickly so everything will move quickly. You got to take care of that. So don't go on. A lot of people go on this kind of Mother Teresa kick where they all of a sudden, I don't need anything, and then the psychology doesn't work out. But that's up for you to figure out. Maybe you don't need much. Maybe you can be a Mother Teresa. Maybe you can be a Martin Luther. Some people can do that. Martin Luther King Jr. or Gandhi or whatever. Some people have that spiritual wealth and that emotional wealth. Some people don't. I find that, you know, I need lots of downtime and occasional McDonald's. And I have to have good quality instruments and really nice hair care products before I feel comfortable. You know, maybe that sounds shallow, but that's what I need. But when I'm feeling really good, I'm a lot more generous and a lot kinder and a lot I'm willing to give more. I try to make sure that when I'm at conventions, I'm real comfortable. So when all those kids come up and talk to me, I've got plenty of emotional wealth to give. I don't know if everybody's going to agree with my philosophy, but I've been on the other end of the philosophy where I'm not emotionally wealthy and I'm still giving, and it sucks. And you get most of emotional wealth from a lot. I talked about a lot of material things. Doing nice things for others can also give you emotional wealth. So if you do a nice gesture, that can give you. I mean, emotional wealth can come from a lot of different places. You know, I love being one of the things I love to do, which gives me a lot of emotional wealth, is I love to talking to my male friends. and girlfriends about relationships and helping them with, you know, giving them advice on relationships. Even though I'm not in a relationship, I've studied them a lot. I'm a big believer in Imago therapy, which Harville Hendrix developed, and I try to get people to communicate that way, and I try to encourage therapy. I'm open about therapy. Like, I've been in therapy myself. I encourage people to do it. I get a lot of emotional wealth out of talking to kids at conventions about exactly what we're talking about. So that gives me emotional wealth. So I'm not saying that, you know, being nice and generous to other people won't give you something back, certainly. But there's definitely a give and take there that has to occur, and it's got to be balanced. And when it's unbalanced is when it's unhealthy, I guess is what I'm saying. So I hope that makes sense.
It really does.
On your quest to be okay, so just make sure you take care of Mike.
Yeah.
And snowball, you take care of all the snowballs out there and flakes. And, no, I'm
awesome.
Kidding. I'm joking.
Like,
all you guys, take care of yourselves.
Yeah,
you know?
like honestly, Sean, just kind of listening to you talk there, I don't know, this is going to sound really stupid, but I'll just say it anyway. Just
you.
Well, I'm straight, dude.
Yeah.
I'm straight. And I won't go out.
Yeah, thanks. But
no, I'm kidding. What?
So you do want to go out with him then?
What were you saying?
Something about that whole spiel. It really kind of hit home, and I'm really glad that I met you. Just because there's something
well,
in that
you.
That really makes sense to me, and it's one of those things I'm probably gonna look at the ceiling myself and really think about. But
yeah.
I said, thank
well,
you, Sean.
Remember, everybody, myself included. You know, everybody's a work in process, and a lot of times it's a two steps forward, one step back kind of a deal. When you're growing, personal growth is definitely painful, but it's always worth it. Even in, I don't know if it's in The Road Less Traveled or one of the books I read, where a guy says his experience with people who have suffered the most, honestly, and experienced a lot of stuff, have grown the most, and they've had the most. I don't think those things are mutually exclusive, but yeah, they're definitely. It's going to be painful, but you know, I know that anytime I'm experiencing emotional pain, I always know that underneath it, I'm experiencing some personal growth, and so then I welcome that. And it's hard, but it's definitely worth it. And Dragon Ball Z has given me an enormous amount of personal growth, just because the situations it put me in and the people I had to deal with. My social skills were horrible. Ask Chris Sabat if you ever get a chance to talk to him about my social skills when I first got on Dragon Ball Z. I had the social skills of a 12-year-old. I was so naive and so stupid and so, you know, I didn't have good boundaries because I didn't grow up in a household with good boundaries, so I didn't have a really good concept of where I ended and other people began, and I would say things that were inappropriate or stupid. And, you know, sometimes I still do that, but I'm definitely aware of it when I do it, and I will definitely not do it when people are like, hey, that bothers me. And used to, I'd be like, oh, come on, it's funny. And like, no. So that's why, like, if I make a joke about anything that bothers you guys, you know, be beyond or that, you know, I'm kidding, but if it really hurts your feelings, let's, you know, we can definitely talk about it. I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. But in the old days, I'd be like, oh, whatever. He's an albino. Everybody makes fun of albinos. It's okay. And it's not cool. You know, it's not cool. And I had to learn those lessons. And being on Dragon Ball Z and having to socialize on a wide forum with a lot of different people caused me to have an enormous amount of personal growth, which I'm still working on, you know, but I don't have the best social skills. I'm still a big believer in free speech, to where I typically do not censor myself in public, and I love New York for that reason, because, you know, saying curse words in public is completely acceptable. One time somebody asked me to not curse in a place, and I looked around and I said, are you kidding me? I'm in New York City. You're asking me not to say the F word in New York City? There are T-shirts on the street that say New York fucking city. Are you kidding me? I would expect that in Texas, and it's actually happened to me before, but in New York, are you kidding me? there's a difference, and this is another thing I feel about censorship. There's a difference between, I learned this when I got in trouble once for cursing in public. There's a difference between I love this fucking sandwich and cursing at someone. And if I say I love this fucking sandwich, I don't think that's a big deal. But if I say F you to a person on the street with anger and intent, that's definitely a negative thing and not a good thing. Because I don't think that, I think if we censor words or we say words, that we become a less enlightened society. And I think the Buddha once said, I don't know if it was Buddha or Bodhidharma, some guy was trying to insult him, and he was like, hey, how come, you know, he wanted to test the Buddha, and he was like, how come you, aren't fazed by this? You know, everybody else would get upset. And he's like, well, the Buddha asked the guy, he said, well, if you buy a present for somebody, and then you offer it to them, and they refuse to take the present, to whom does the present belong? And he said, well, the present belongs, I guess, to the person that bought it. And he goes, Well, I view your words, your insults to me, as presents. I refuse to accept them. Basically, he's saying that I don't care what you say to me. I don't accept them as a present, and therefore, they're yours. You're cursing at yourself. But not everybody thinks that way, and there are definitely different viewpoints and, you know, different philosophies out there, and it's hard for me to deal with all that when I've got all this going on in my head, and, you know, people get upset when you say this, that, or the other, because they're all sensitive, and I'm sensitive to certain things, too, so it's, you know, we all got to be respectful, I guess. As we live on this planet, that, you know, there are too many people on, so, well, that's some dangerous stuff. Don't even get me started on that, because, I just think the Earth's going to consume itself, and then we're like a giant bacterial infection, and then we're going to heat up the Earth. A bunch of people are going to die. We'll stop doing what we're doing, and then eventually we'll balance out. But I don't think that I want to believe that the efforts of Al Gore are going to pay off and people like him, but I'm really afraid they're not. And that's Canada's going to have a lot of nice green land once everything melts up there. It's going to be really beautiful.
Some prime real estate, eh?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, it's going to be prime real estate right in the middle where nobody lives, all that land underneath that glacier. Boy, that's going to be nice.
Oh, yeah.
You know? And then America's going to be a desert. Oh, my God, this is terrible. It really is. I mean, I'm joking, but it's serious and it's terrible, and I'm really starting to wonder if it's too late. And people don't also factor in the other greenhouse gas that we're emitting. Everybody breathing. That is another greenhouse gas that we don't talk about a lot. Like, oh, we're driving too many cars. Oh, cows are farting too much. Oh, yeah? Well, guess what? So are we, and there's 6 billion of us.
We should all just stop breathing. You know, that'll work.
You know, honestly, I would never suggest that we, you know, I think the humanity will take, there'll probably be some crazy super virus that'll wipe out a bunch of people, and then the problem will slowly be corrected, but I do think the Earth is kind of a living thing, and we're, you know, I'm starting to think that things that happen, like the earthquake in Indonesia and these hurricanes, are not an accident. It's like the Earth's immune system is going, okay, people, there are too many of you, and I'm going to get rid of some of you. You know, I wonder
if too many of you buggers. We need to get rid of some.
I wonder if the Earth's doing that in its own cosmic way. Who knows? But
I kind of like that idea.
That's very dark, but
I think it's probably reality. You know,
it probably is.
And,
I'm hoping we can turn it around, though.
I'm hoping we can too. But we got to make some radical, you know, if I were president, I'd be like, no more driving except for emergency vehicles. I mean, that's the way, I'd be hardcore. I'd be like, really, there's no more driving, period. You got to get an electric car or something. There's no more driving except for commercial vehicles. And all that land we got out in the Midwest, all going to be solar panels and wind, you know, it'd be right away. Like, oh, it's too expensive. I'm like, it's too expensive. We just spent billions of dollars on a war. You're telling me a bunch of solar panels are too expensive? That's completely ridiculous.
That's it. Goku for president 2008.
Exactly. Sean, run for president. You would have the youth vote.
I'm not qualified to be president in any way, shape, or form. But
neither is George Bush, but he's still there.
George, the only saving grace of George Bush is I'm hoping that the political system in America here's the only positive thing about George Bush that I can glean, and I'm trying to be really positive here, is that he sucks so bad that... He sucks so bad, either that he's secretly doing that, and he's really secretly smart, or, which I don't think is true, or he sucks so bad that our American political system, like an immune system, like a human immune system, will fight back so hard that our standards will be so much higher that our next president will be really kick-ass to balance out his suckiness. That's what I'm hoping, had we had a mediocre president the last 8 years, we'd still be kind of mediocre. So, like, we've had this low point, this pendulum that swung downward. So I'm hoping that because of that, everybody's like, okay, we absolutely have to have it. And so it'll be like an immune system kicking in and you know, really eradicating this completely lovable but moronic person. you know, can't say the word nuclear. And, you know, for some reason, you know, I watched him try to say, somebody asked him about some state sovereignty, and he goes, well, they're just that. They're sovereign. It's like, you know, when you're in high school and you don't know the meaning of the word of a sentence, and they go, you sovereign in a sentence. And they go, the people were sovereign. You know, that's not the right answer. You know, because you didn't define the word sovereign. I thought that was really funny. And then he's admitting to secret prisons, and then, like, when he's making waterboarding sound like it's something you do at Wet n' Wild. And I'm like, what? Because first I heard about it, I was like, let's go waterboarding, everybody.
But apparently it's a very terrible thing to do to people. And he's doing it, or you know, he or whoever is doing it illegally. And I just want our own, you know, Justice Department and legal system to be self-congruent. You know, Bill Clinton, you know, has a little sex and he gets impeached. You know, we got George Bush with secret prisons and waterboarding, and nobody's using the word impeachment? What is wrong with this picture?
See, this is for the clip show once again.
What I love about George Bush is the fact that basically he says all this stuff and then all of a sudden just randomly puts in there, and we're going to the moon. It's like, what? Wait, what would you say? It's like, I think he just sits in the White House and then he looks up at the moon and goes, I want to be there.
Yeah,
this place is screwed up.
What I think is really interesting is like he's done a lot for education and No Child Left Behind program and stuff like that. And I'm thinking he's probably going, well, I got left behind. I wasn't educated. I feel sorry for those stupid little kids because I was left behind, and I want to, you know, because he's putting his money where his heart is. So I like to blow things up, and I feel bad because I was uneducated. So, you know, that's the way it comes across to me. I'm just like, well, he's doing stuff for, I mean, apparently the educational stuff he's done, I don't know all the details. Supposedly are very good, but I think it's interesting to me that I live in the richest country in America, and I know school districts where they don't have books. And I'm like, okay, you just built a $1 trillion bomb, and there are school districts where they don't have books? Are you kidding me? You know, that's just preposterous, you know. So,
great, we got the Ralph Wiggum of presidents.
Yeah, who's Ralph Wiggum?
Wiggum from Simpsons.
Oh, Ralph Wiggum. Yeah. Oh, Ralph Wiggum. Who's Ralph Williams? But anyway, I don't know if this is what you guys wanted on This Week in Geek. I guess it's pretty geeky. We're talking about politics, philosophy, video games, girls, and I guess we need to talk about boobs at some point. Oh, here's a geeky thing we can talk about, boobs. Okay, so this will be funny. Since it's This Week in Geek, we have to talk about boobs. Okay, so you're going to love this. Me and my friend Ralph's like a biologist, and I was like, okay, no matter how old I get and no matter how many boobs I see, I never get sick of them, but if I see other things, I get sick of them. Is there boob math? Is there a mathematical curve that is so complex that it unlocks something in my brain? So we were trying to figure out what boob math is. Like, why is it that men, you know, heterosexual men at least, obsess about boobs? No matter how many we see of them, we just don't get tired of them. I mean, I'm 39. You know, I'd like them just as much as the day I first saw them. So, and I've been around them, I've seen a lot of them, you know, but is there a mathematical formula, like if you could take, I don't know if it's a Boolean math or what kind of math it is, geometry, and you could calculate, Ralph is like, well, we got to figure out what the boob math is, and if we can unlock that key, we might be free of boob math. But then I guess that key would make us gay, I don't know, what would that be? I don't know what that would make us. So there, we talked about boobs in a geeky way.
That reminds me of a quote that Ron White, the comedian, says. He goes, you see one woman naked, you want to see the rest of them naked.
It's very true.
Yeah. It's not if you've seen one, you've seen them all. It's like if you've seen one, you want to see the rest of them.
Yeah, exactly.
You got to catch them all, so to speak.
You got to catch them all, yeah. And then women get, the funny thing is, the irony is women get disgusted, yet they have all these products that are designed to trick us into liking their boobs more, such as Miracle Bras, such as boob jobs. So you get mad because we're looking at boobs, and then you want us to look at boobs. So which one is it? You're mad at us for looking at your boobs, but then you do things to make us look at your boobs. So
this is going
in
the clip show.
This is a Sean Schimmel rant for our show.
So make up your mind, you know? If you're going to use boobs for power, then, you know, pick one. So
this is the most eclectic interview ever.
Yes.
I told you, I'm aware of my caveman. I know, I'm not above it. I am a caveman. I walk into a room and I smell the pheromones of another woman. I'm like, mate, immediately. Of course, I don't, but my brain, I can feel my brain going, who do I want to mate with? You know, I'm aware of it. It's actually kind of, it makes my head hurt sometimes. It's like, sometimes I'm so aware of it. I'm like, okay, I can't even walk. I don't know if I have a synesthesia quality to my brain that I have maybe everybody sees the world this way and I'm the only guy who's articulating it. I don't know, but, you know, that's,
Wow. We need to keep having you back so we can do a continuing series of the musings of Sean Schimmel.
Exactly. I think
I'm just going to do my own radio
that's
show
it.
Called What the Fuck Is That? My new radio show is going to go, what the fuck is up? You know? And it's going to be like, what the fuck is up with boobs? What the fuck is up with Bush? What the fuck is up with albinos? What the fuck is up with black albinos? What the fuck is up with guys who look like Oliver Twist? I don't know. I mean, it'd be like my show's called, what the fuck is up?
That's it.
And then we just talk about things.
By the people who brought you This Week in Geek.
Oh, my God.
This is totally it.
This Week in Geek? I don't know. Yeah, you see why I'm single now, though, because this is the kind of shit I talk about on dates. And the girls are like, what? You know? And what I'm looking for is the girl that wants to talk about this shit, who's also hot. That's the other problem. I don't deny the fact that I want to go out with a hot woman, you know?
I think so we all do at one point.
Yeah, I'm like, why can't I have it all, you know?
Oh, man.
You will live our dream.
Well, here's a funny story. I was having drinks with a guy I met. He was a brilliant African-American doctor. His name is Anthony. And he was making fun of the Watson Report, where Watson said all these derogatory things about African-Americans based on, you know, faux genetics. And this guy won a Nobel Prize. And he is very, very funny. The doctor I was talking to, he's an internist. He's very, very funny. And he was saying, you know, he was making fun of Watson's comments, and he's like, well, apparently I can be a brilliant doctor, but I can't have a giant dick either. And he was saying that, according to Watson, apparently I cannot have it all. And so the whole night he kept making fun of the fact, like, nope, I have a very, very small dick. Or he'd reverse it and go, well, I'm a terrible doctor, but I have a huge dick. Apparently I cannot be a good doctor. And, you know, he was a very funny man. I just met him. I played this concert, and I met him. He's a very funny guy, and he was making fun of that thing, and he'd be great to have on the show, because we already have a show. We got a show now. We got funding.
That's right.
We got a show, but no, he was very funny making fun of that whole thing that geneticist, I don't know, Watson was talking about, and he got lambasted by the entire scientific community for saying racial things about, you know, African-Americans or Africans in general, which were totally not true and totally not substantiated by any science whatsoever. I mean, if that were the case, then Snowflake would have a tiny, tiny dick, and we all know that's not true, so...
Well, of course, like, yeah.
This just got very awkward.
because the converse, I was using converse logic.
Right, because that always works.
Wow. No, I don't know. It was... I have a lot of jokes like that about, like, my friend, Michael Sidra-Nicholas, he's a voice actor, a good friend of mine. He has a lot of very tiny electronic gadgets. And I'm like, that must mean you must have like a giant schlong, because guys who buy big giant gadgets, like big cars and big boats and big four-wheel drive, supposedly have very small genitalia, and because you have tiny remote control cars, he loves to collect those tiny electronics. And I go, and he actually likes to quote me when he's talking to the ladies, because he's like, well, my friend Sean says, and of course I do not know, I have no carnal knowledge, but I'm just like making a joke, and of course now he's using it to perpetuate the myth of his, well, I don't know if he's using it to get laid, but to perpetuate the myth of his manhood, I don't know.
you're like that kid from the Cosby Show, like Kenny's brother. You know what my brother says.
Oh, yeah. That's true. Okay, I understand here's another thing, I understand the Cosby Show. I love Bill Cosby, I'm such a huge fan of his, but the oldest Cosby daughter, I am whiter than. So I'm like, okay, I couldn't believe that Bill Cosby and Felicia Rashad had this baby. I was like, okay, all the other kids, I believe, with the exception of Lisa Bonet a little bit, I'm like, was Sandra LaBeouf, was she the milkman, and or was she Snowball and the Felicia Rashad
maybe
kid?
Because maybe she was mine, you never know.
Because I get tanner than she does when I go tanning, when I go in the sun. I just didn't. So I was watching the Cosby Show, and then she came on. I was like, that's not their kid. I never bought it for a split second. The rest of the kids, you know, Theo, I believe. But the other kids, I'm like, that's not their kid. Oh, and do you guys also notice that the girl, the lady on the Honey Bunches of Oats, the Honey Bunches commercial where they're at the factory, looks just like Steve Urkel?
Yes.
Am I the only person that's noticed that?
Yes, oh, like, my God, yes.
You know what I'm talking about? She's got the hairnet on, and she's like, now she had a commercial, when she's actually a factory worker, apparently, and then she, I think it's a she, and then she got, you know, a series of commercials because she was so entertaining, apparently, and then I see her on the commercials, I'm like, that's Steve Urkel. What is Steve Urkel doing and then I watched that movie, No Country for Old Men, which is a great film, by the way, and I'm
oh,
like,
really
why
film.
does And I'm like, why does Nicolas Cage have a wig and a Spanish accent? But then I realized it was a different actor. You know? Maybe I have synesthesia when it comes to people. I can't. But to me, that guy in the No Country for Old Men looks like Spanish Nicolas. He has like a Spanish kind of accent, and he's got a wig on. Well, looks like Nicolas Cage wearing a wig, and he's like apparently a much better actor. No, I don't know if that's true. But
well, I don't know. I think he's pretty good. I mean, my favorite scene in that movie was the when he's in the that gas station and he does the whole quarter thing.
Yeah, that was great.
Oh man, that was like I was scared of that guy then, but I totally agree. He's like the Spanish Nicolas Cage.
Oh, Lord.
Yeah, it was really weird. The fun thing was they were in Odessa, Texas, or in West Texas in 1980, and that was really creepy for me because I lived there in 1980 as a little kid. So when they're at the very end where they're going down the street, I don't want to give anything away, but they're going down the street and those kids show up on a bicycle.
Yeah.
I used to bike around Odessa, Texas with my shirt off just like that, running around, you know. It was very accurately done. I was really impressed because I had lived there at that time period, and it added to my suspension of disbelief. It's one of the reasons I can't watch musicals in live theater. It's hard to suspend my disbelief, so anytime I watch a musical, I'm like, why are people randomly breaking into song? Nobody does that. And if I'm watching a theater, and there's a lot of good theater in New York, and I even went to see Proof, and I was like, why are there people talking loud on stage? I can't get past the loud talking because they're talking loud to project to the back of the audience, and then I'm like, I'm in a room with a bunch of other people, and there's people on stage talking loud and expressing a lot of emotion. I can do theater, but it takes a lot. You know, really got to suspend my disbelief for me to believe it. Because I just think it's bullshit otherwise. But, you know, I have a lot. I do support and have a lot of friends in musical theater, and I support and respect the art form, definitely. But people have been doing a lot of musicals in New York, and I'm like, I've been to one. I've been to Avenue Q, which I had worked in a puppet theater, so I really liked it. I worked as a marionettist in a marionette theater in Dallas. That's where I got my start, actually. Anyway, that's another story. So we've talked about, is there any questions you have for me? Or?
Well, I think we have to wrap this up. Well, Steve, we've been talking today with Sean Schemmel. I've honestly would say this is the most eclectic, and I will say this is our best interview we've ever done.
I would have to agree. I have never learned so much in an hour and a half than I ever have in my entire life.
Yeah, like honestly, as Sean talked during the interview about personal growth and all that and philosophy and then George Bush, it's been a very eclectic hour. So Sean, yes. Thank you so much for doing this for us.
Well, it was a lot of fun, and thanks for letting me just kind of have a free-for-all. A lot of interviews don't do that. It's always a pleasure to talk to you guys. I'm sorry I've been hard to get a hold of. And I appreciate everybody who, you know, who calls in or watches what I'm doing. And, you know, I am paying attention, even though I tend to keep a low profile. And I do watch what people say, and I do listen to what they're doing. And I appreciate everything everybody says, and I care as much as I can. You know, when I'm in the booth is where I do the most caring. So I try to care, you know, when I'm recording, that it's got to be awesome. And I want kids to really have their disbelief suspended so that it's a more powerful experience for them and so that they can enjoy it more. So I appreciate all that, and I try to show that when I'm working. So anyway, it's been great talking to you guys. And I hope I didn't hurt anybody's feelings by making fun of you extremely a lot. No, I'm kidding. And I wasn't trying to hurt anybody's feelings. I'm just playing around. I know I'm the biggest, goofiest guy around, so whatever. And thank you.
Perfect.
But yeah, so Steve.
And I wanna,
oh, sorry. Go ahead, Sean.
No, I was, and I want a hamburger now.
I will give you a cheeseburger. I'll go even better.
Yeah.
We'd be glad to see you on Tuesday for today.
Gotta love Whoopi, wow. That bastard.
And the professionalism.
Follow me now.
And the professionalism is out the window.
Yes.
But yes, for This Week in Geeks fan service, we have been
A bewildered Steve Snowball Sailor.
I've, of course, been Mike the Birdman Dodd, and we've been joined with.
And I'm just all the way from Jersey City, New Jersey.
That's ever-lovable Sean Schemmel. We'll be back next month with a new episode of Twig Fan Service. I'm not sure what we're going to be talking about.
Hey, you guys should call up Sister Nicholas and Savitt and corroborate all the crap I said. That'd be funny.
If you can get us the contact information, we will do it.
I'll have to call them and ask them, but sure, yeah, we can. That'd be funny.
Cool.
Done.
All right, then. So for This Week in Geeks fan service, I've been Mike the Birdman Dodd saying live free or die hard.
Want to see me make bubbles with my spit?
Sure do. In fact, that's the theme of our next show. So don't miss it.
Capitalism! Freaking capitalism! Where's our cut?
The Birdman has lost his mind. Stay tuned next week when he evidently doesn't find it again.
See, the moose are extinct. We shot the last one. That's all urban legend.
Stay tuned next week for Electric Boogaloo. Coming up next.
You've been listening to This Week in Geek. Tune in next week when you hear Mike say...
And don't forget to spay or neuter your pet, noob.
So make sure to tune in next week on 90.1 FM, The Heat, Niagara's new rock. Check out our website at thisweekingeek.net for more geek content, as well as subscribe to our podcast through iTunes or any podcatcher. If you'd like to comment about this week's episode, head to our forums at thisweekingeek.net/forums. We'll see you next week, and remember...
Lower your shields and surrender your listenership.
I can't believe it.
That Gerald is presenting the quarterly budget report with finger puppets?
Look, here comes a 1.7% decrease in fixed overhead. Hello, everybody.
No, I can't believe how easy it was to save hundreds of dollars on my car insurance with Geico.
Who are you? The projected increase in organic Q3 revenue. Hooray!
Believe it. Geico could save you 15% or more on car insurance.
You shouldn't go to Barnes & Noble and buy 10,000 books just so you can build a book fortress and yell out, "I am your book leader." You shouldn't buy 147 copies of War and Peace, stuff them inside turkeys, and serve them at Thanksgiving as turbookins. And you definitely shouldn't buy up all the copies of Dork Diaries, causing the neighborhood kids to stage a protest in your front yard. But you could, because at the Barnes & Noble Book Hall, you can get over 1,000 titles for 50% off. Stock up at your local Barnes & Noble. Turbookins are fictitious and should not be cooked at home.